As if emerald ash borers and Japanese beetles weren't enough, Iowa is now home to a new invasive species, the jumping worm. They're also known as crazy worms or snake worms, and their arrival is not good news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis will be here along with Aaron Style of Ryman Gardens in Ames. We'll talk about the jumping worm, how it got here, how quickly it might spread, the kind of damage it does, and precautions you might want to take. And then Donald and Aaron will answer your questions about plants and insects. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. And of course, we will be taking your questions about the plants and insects in your life a little later on. But we're going to start the hour with an invasive species that just made its way to Iowa. It's called the jumping worm. And my guests today are Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Wonderful to have you. And Aaron Style, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. And Donald, I realize that the jumping worm is not an insect and your specialty is insects, but I also know that you've been answering a lot of questions about this worm. So first of all, where is it in Iowa?
Well, that's a great question, and I wish we had a better answer to where it is in Iowa. We have documented the presence of jumping worm in Dubuque and Muscatine counties. But since the news broke a week ago that it was here and that we were looking for it, we've heard from lots of other people, and it may be in lots more places than what we originally realized. Of course, it's been in New England for a decade. It's been in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. It has been around us, and it was probably here for a much longer time than we realize. But, of course, Dubuque's closeness to Wisconsin, they had actually been looking for it, and they were the ones that first reported it to us. But I also now have a sample that's waiting for confirmation from Cedar Rapids, some from Des Moines, from some southeast Iowa. So it's probably much more widespread than we realized.
Okay. Now let's talk about what it is. I mean, obviously, this is a worm.
It is an earthworm. And for in general appearance, it looks like all the other annelids, all the other earthworms, a long tubular body, no legs. And then lots and lots of segments, lots of wrinkles between the segments of the body. So it looks like other earthworms, except this one is darker in color. And a mature earthworm, that is one that's old enough to reproduce, has a ring or a collar around the body, partway back from the head, that's called the clitellum. And in our regular night crawlers and our regular garden worms, the clitellum is this raised structure that's usually fairly pink in color. On the jumping worm, the clitellum is smooth and it is nearly white. So there are morphological differences that you would use to tell this worm, the jumping worm, from our other night crawlers and garden worms, but it's the behavior for which the worm is named that most people will recognize it.
Right. Okay, let's talk about that. And I am not averse to worms. But when I first saw a video of the jumping worm, I have to say it freaked me out a little bit. They are surprising. What do they do?
They writhe, which is a word that I'm not really sure how to pronounce, let alone exactly what it means. But they writhe and squirm. They wiggle like crazy. They jump. And when they're disturbed, they will actually lift off the ground with this jumping motion that they have. So this violent wiggling back and forth when disturbed is the first thing people notice. Some people compare them to a snake, the way they slither back and forth in a rapid fashion. But the name jumping worm fits them very, very well.
All right. Now, Iowa doesn't have any native earthworms, do we?
Oh, we had to back up on that. We had to backtrack when we said there were no native earthworms. If you live in the glaciated part of Iowa, that is where the Des Moines lobe of the glacier came down 10 to 12,000 years ago, you do not have any native earthworms. All the earthworms you have are recent introductions and mostly of European origin that came with the European settlers who found this rich prairie after the glaciers had receded some 10,000 years previously. In the southern half of Iowa that was not glaciated more recently, there are still native earthworms, species that were in North America originally. So our statement, our first statement that there were no native earthworms was only true for the northern half of the state. It does not apply to the southern part of the state.
Okay. But most of the earthworms that we are familiar with, that we interact with on a regular basis, are actually from somewhere else.
They all came from somewhere else, and the Europeans brought them with them because they filled the bottoms of their sailing vessels with soil as ballast to hold the ship upright. And when they got to the New World, they shoveled the ballast out onto the shore, and they filled the bottom of the boat back up with treasures that they found in the New World to take back to Europe or Asia. And it's that introduction of soil and later the introduction of plants, the movement of plants and people and their materials around the country, that brought us earthworms that are nearly all of European or Asian origin.
And earthworms are considered to be beneficial, right?
They're great. We have lots of good things to say about earthworms, how they aerate the soil, how they bring organic matter into the soil, how they fertilize the soil with their casts, which is a fancy word for earthworm poop, and all the benefit they bring to granulating the soil and helping it hold moisture. So we love earthworms. We love the benefits that they provide to the soil under most circumstances.
All right. Now, where does the jumping worm come from?
The jumping worm appears to have come from Southeast Asia. We don't know exactly when, but it's been in the United States now for a decade and has been moved around with plant material, with sod, with soil, with potted trees. Maybe even just the soil that sticks to the treads of your boots could be enough to move the little tiny cocoons, which is how the earthworm spends the winter. So it got around quite easily after it got here, after its original introduction from Asia.
And why are we worried? If earthworms tend to be beneficial, why are we concerned about the jumping worm?
The jumping worm has several characteristics that make it better at surviving than our regular earthworms. They grow more rapidly. They reproduce more quickly. They have more offspring per female. They will feed on almost any organic matter. They're not very picky eaters. And they exist at very high densities. There can be dozens to hundreds of them in a fairly small area. Those are characteristics that allow them to outcompete, that is, to elbow aside the earthworms that are already here. So instead of having a diversity of species in the areas where the jumping worm establishes, it takes over. It bullies out the other species, and we lose the diversity. The second problem is they are just voracious eaters. The jumping worms feed on organic matter in your soil till there's nothing left. And then your soil is poor for holding water, it's poor for growing plants, and if you lose the debris off the top of the soil, especially on sloped woodlands, now you have more erosion, you have more soil loss, you have other problems. So there are reasons to hate the jumping worm that don't apply to our other worms, but it's going to be a mess for a lot of people for years to come.
All right, so they're a problem because they do what other worms do, but they do it too efficiently.
They do it much better, and especially the consumption of organic matter and especially the ability to reproduce. If you can have more offspring than your competitor, you eventually can beat them.
And they tend to live closer to the surface?
They are surface dwellers. They are not the subsurface earthworms like the night crawlers. They are more like our compost worms that live just in the leaf litter at the top, and more like our garden worms that are at the surface rather than in deep burrows.
So what should you do if you see a jumping worm right now at this point when we're trying to establish where they are?
You can take videos or images and send them to us here at Iowa State University. We are trying to document where all it is located. We're a little slow in responding right now because we don't have our full staff available here at the end of the summer.
Three more weeks.
Students will be here. We'll have all of our staff back in place. So we're trying to document the presence. Do not move plants. Do not move soil from one place to another. Look for jumping earthworms in potted plants or in other materials before you move them. if you have them, we're sorry, there's not much you can do.
Oh, that was my next question. Yeah, so
you thought there would be a miracle pill that you would put on your soil.
Yeah, just like the Japanese beetle and the emerald ash borer. No.
Yeah, well, it's more like the Japanese beetle in that one of the suggestions, and I am making this with a twinkle in my eye, realizing how ridiculous this sounds, one of the suggestions is to pick them up, bag them, and kill them. And, of course, we say that about Japanese beetles, like it would be easy to do. Oh, you just go out and you pick them off and you drown them in soapy water. It's ridiculous to think about that in an invasion in both circumstances. But if you found a few of them, that would be your first line of defense, would be to try to limit the population to reduce the amount that it would reproduce and spend the winter. It's not going to be easy, and there's lots of research going on thinking there should be some tea oil compounds or some low nitrogen fertilizers. There should be something out there that would help reduce the population. So far, all the experts to the east of us looking for that solution have not found it, but we wish them well, and we hope they find a solution soon.
So as you mentioned, I mean, these worms have been making their way west for a long time. So if we go out to the East Coast, where they've been for a long time, what kind of damage do we see?
A couple of things. We see no litter on the forest floor. So the forest that should have this deep, rich layer of decaying leaf material is now bare soil that's eroding. The other thing is these earthworms change the composition of the soil rather than these large granules that we're used to seeing in soil, rather than that structure that we know holds water and roots. The soil is reduced to the texture of coffee grounds. So it no longer holds roots well. It no longer holds water well. So we see all these ecological changes as a result of what these worms are capable of doing by consuming more organic matter than they should.
This is not good news.
No, and, you know, we could whine about Japanese beetle and emerald ash borer, and, of course, now we have mile-a-minute weed. It's always something.
And I'm sure we'll see more invasive species in the coming years as well. So we're not supposed to move plants. That seems like a pretty high bar for a lot of people.
We
move plants all the time.
And we have pass-along plants that we have these hostas that we divide and share with our friends. And we love to take cuttings and root them in soil and then move those around the country. And we have this huge nursery industry that's the income depends upon us buying plants. And we just need to be smart consumers and check where the plants came from and check for worms in the soil if we're buying them, especially in the end of the summer. But this is not going to be easy to do, and it's not going to be easy to contain, as the current distribution would already indicate. There are some groups that have stopped having plant sales because of this, but knowing what to look for is the first step.
All right. We have been talking about the jumping worm, a new invasive species in the state of Iowa. With me, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University professor of entomology. He knows this is not an insect we've been talking about. Aaron Stile, assistant director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, is also here with us. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants and insects in your life. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions about the plants or insects you encounter. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. And Aaron, I think you were on the show a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about things being too wet for gardens.
I know. All those people who are complaining about how wet it was and wishing it would stop raining got their wish granted.
Yeah, so things are very, very dry.
They are. If you're not watering, especially in the vegetable garden for a lot of the state, you probably might want to consider it.
Right. Need to get out there with some water. Hopefully we'll get some rain in the near future. But it's amazing how quickly things can change. And I know we'll have a conversation about the dryness on River to River today coming up at noon. Let's get to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Glenn is on the line in Slater. Hi, Glenn. Glenn, are you there? Hi, Glenn.
Yeah, hi, Charity.
Yeah, what's your question?
Yeah, Dr. Lewis, well, I I was planning on digging up a bunch of plants and moving them across several states here shortly. And so I just wanted to get a little more clarity on that from Dr. Lewis, if I could.
Right. You just told us not to move plants, Donald.
Don't move plants. Well, maybe we should qualify that and say, in those areas where we have confirmed the jumping worm, moving plants would be the worst possible idea. If you have not confirmed them, if you have no evidence of jumping worms, if you haven't seen this unusual behavior, then moving plants would be okay. And we're going to continue to do that. And saying don't move plants is one of those ivory tower academic kinds of things that it's easy for me to say, but it's going to be impossible for the world to adhere to. So with care, with caution, with your eyes wide open, look for jumping worms and make those decisions of what you can and cannot move safely without contributing to the problem.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Dr. Lewis. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Glenn. Yeah,
thanks a lot for your call. So if you are going to be moving plants and you're in an area where it hasn't been confirmed, you should try to thoroughly check those plants?
Yes, and this is not easy to do either. Here I am at the garden center trying to pick out a crabapple tree, and I'm picking out the right variety I want, and now I'm down on my hands and knees, and I've got my fingernails in the soil, and I'm likely to get kicked out of the garden center for destroying that plant by trying to inspect it. There's not going to be easy answers to this, and we go through this with other problems. Make sure what you buy is healthy and pest-free, and we say these things like it's going to be easy to do. And it's not going to be easy to do, but because we're aware of this problem, it now falls to all of us to do what we can to check for the problem.
All right. Back to the phones. Diane is on the line in Sigourney. Hi, Diane.
Yes, I have tussock moss on my milkweed that I planted for my monarchs. What should I do with them?
Enjoy them. They seem to coexist quite well. The milkweed tussock moth is an orange and black, fairly small, fuzzy caterpillar that tends to be on the top of the plant, and monarchs tend to like the lower leaves, so they can coexist. There's no reason you have to kill one in hopes of getting the other. But if you feel the tussock moths are somehow in your way, what I would do is prune off the part of the plant where they are and move them somewhere else. So I don't think you need to do anything with milkweed tussock moth other than enjoy the variety of things that are capable of utilizing milkweed as a food source. I mean, think of that. The plant is toxic, but yet here are all these different insects that are able to overcome the toxins the plant produces and live there happily and peacefully coexist.
All right, Diane, thank you so much for your call. And let's do an email here. Derek wrote, we have several birch trees on our property in Cedar Rapids, four of them in a straight row on the north side of the house, one out of the group. Its leaves are turning yellow and drying up. They all get the same amount of sun and water. Any ideas about what could be going wrong?
Well, I mean, there's a couple different things, but especially with the way the weather has been lately, you know, even if these are all in a row and seem to be in relatively the same place, soil conditions are going to vary. The way that that tree established or how well it is established in that area could vary a little bit too. The yellowing of leaves, especially in a dry period, to me says that the plant's a little dry. So you want to check the soil, dig down a little bit, see if it's still dry. If it is dry, you'll want to water with like a low sprinkler, preferably in the morning. Try to get that soil soaked. The other thing that impacts birches a lot in Iowa is iron chlorosis. It's partly because of our higher pH soils. There's plenty of iron in the soil in most cases, but it's not available for the plant to use because of the pH of the soil. And so that's another issue that we run into with birch and other plants. Pin oak is notorious for this too. Changing the pH of your soil is a tall order. It can be really difficult to do. There are kind of chelated iron sprays that you can put on the foliage to green them back up again. The good news is that with iron chlorosis, with an established tree, we don't usually see that be the reason why the tree might fail, but it does stress the plant out, making it more vulnerable to other things.
And it's unusual, isn't it, all of these birch trees are in the exact same environment,
well,
or at least seem to be.
Yeah, they seem to be. And it may be that plant, you know, that spot may have been where, you know, if it's by a house, maybe that's where the contractor dumped a bunch of stuff. And we don't know that that's a pile where they cleaned out the cement truck or something like that. So it's hard to know for sure, even though it seems that the whole area is very, very uniform. It may not be.
And of course, the other thing we sometimes fail to realize is that trees are individuals.
Yes.
Just like Aaron, yes. Charity and I don't look alike. We may not have the same susceptibilities. Trees can be individuals as well.
All right. Here's another email question. This is from Chris. When is a good time to transplant false indigo? They're about 3 years old.
Moving this plant can be really difficult. It really dislikes being moved. So honestly, I would say if you don't have to move it, I probably wouldn't. If you do have to move it, I would do that very early in the spring when it's first coming up out of the ground. Get as much of that root ball as you can and try to keep that root ball intact when you move it. But it will pout after you after you transplant it. That's one of false indigo's things.
So be prepared for pouting.
Be prepared. Yeah, be prepared.
All right. Dan is on the line in Palo. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
So I just planted a Norway spruce out of a 1 gallon pot yesterday, and the yard that I planted it into is mostly clay, and I was just wondering if there's anything I could do to get it to take root better or anything I can do to help improve its chances of surviving.
Hopefully you didn't put it too deep in the ground. That would definitely help a lot. Most of our evergreens in Iowa really don't love our heavy clay soils in certain areas. And so planting it a little on the high side can help some. Mulching it, of course, will help. And this time of year, very carefully and very carefully watering it will be really important. While I said that they don't like the heavy clay soils because water, they tend to hold more water, this time of year tends to be drier, and they do need that extra irrigation, especially when it's dry, to help get well established. So watering deeply, checking the soil several times a week now through at least the end of October, and making sure that if that soil is dry down 4 or 5 inches, that you're doing a nice, thorough, deep watering on that plant when you see it.
Alrighty.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Dan. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Jay on the line in Des Moines. Oh, Jay is no longer with us. Let's answer an email question here. Suzanne writes, I know the Christmas season is over 4 months away, but is there something I should be doing soon to make sure my Christmas cactus blooms on time? Last year, it had several blooms, but they came on later than Christmas. I know this must make me seem like a fanatic, but this plant belonged to my mother-in-law, and for her, it always bloomed on time. Now that she's passed, my husband is just thrilled when it blooms. I'd like to carry on the tradition if I can.
If it typically bloomed during the kind of Christmas season, it may be that this plant would be better off in a room that you don't use very often. There's a few things that trigger flowering that all have to come together, temperature, and but one of the big ones is day length. And so if you're artificially or accidentally lengthening the day length because this thing's in a room that you use a lot, it will delay when it flowers. And so putting it in a spare bedroom and the window in a spare bedroom that you don't use very often and then moving it out once it flowers might be a way to get around that. If it bloomed at that time in the past and isn't anymore. If it was a plant that always seems to bloom a little late, then that's just when it blooms. And there won't be anything you can do to get around that.
But I can imagine that a beloved plant that reminds you of a beloved person, you might put it in a place of honor and unwittingly extend the day length because
yes.
It's in that special place.
Yes, yeah. And we often see this, especially if these plants are in kitchens or dining rooms, because we tend to use those kind of later or, you know, into the evening at a time where it could artificially extend the day length. Now, day length isn't the only thing that causes Christmas cactus to bloom either. It also needs the right temperatures and some other things too. But normally we reach those in our homes without any issue.
All right. Here's a question from Joe. For you, Donald, is potting soil a possible transmitter of jumping worms?
Well, yes, it could be. I would think garden soil would be more likely. If potting soil is being processed at all, it's probably not highly likely to have them. One of the things that we know about the jumping worm is they die at high temperatures. And that's why composting would be one way to eliminate the cocoons of the jumping worm and the worms themselves. And I believe the temperature is like 109 or 110. So it's not all that hot. And if you have a compost pile that's getting up to a good temperature, it's killing lots of things, including the jumping worms. So if potting soil is going through any kind of a heating process to get it bagged into you, they would have taken care of that problem.
We sometimes have heat indexes that high. And I mean, I know that they seem to like forested areas. Does that mean that maybe they won't be as big a problem in sort of our wide open spaces that do get so hot during the summer?
This may not be an agricultural pest.
This
may be a landscape and woodland pest where soil temperatures tend to be a little cooler because of the shading. They may not exist out in the middle of your turf grass lawn because of the heats that are out there. But it's still going to find places to live. So far, this seems to be a problem in mostly the northern half of the United States, so maybe there is some connection to heat. But back to his question about potting soil, we hope we're buying from reputable dealers that are somehow processing that soil in a way that would eliminate that risk.
All right. This one may be outside your area of expertise, Donald. Another person asks, do these jumping worms make good fish bait?
Well, I think so, because of the vigorous activity of
them. The wriggling would be attractive.
Get them on the hook, right?
If you can get them on the hook. But, and we immediately underline and bold the rest of the sentence, and that is, please don't move jumping worms on purpose. If you're taking jumping worms from an area where they have been found and you're dropping them along the bank of the shore where you're doing your fishing, you have been part of the problem. So while they may make good fish bait, I would say don't do it. There are other good fish baits. You don't need to be part of the problem moving this worm to a new area where it hasn't already established. So I tend to be fairly persnickety about that one, that no, don't use this one for fish bait. Let's not be part of the problem.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Joe is on the line in Grundy Center. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Good morning.
What's your question?
All right. Well, I've got a little bit of a mystery for you. I'm just bought my first home. I've never grown anything in my life, so maybe it's not a mystery. But I planted a bunch of morning glories on my chain link fence, and they've spread. They've grown, and they look beautiful. But I also planted a bunch of sweet pea interspersed between them. Now, the sweet pea have grown up to about a foot and a half tall, and then they completely stopped. They're not growing, they're not dying, they're not withering, they still have the nice little tendrils shooting out and wrapping around the chain link, but they just won't grow anymore, and I am perplexed. Any thoughts?
Well, Morning Glory loves the weather we've had lately much more than Sweet Pea does, so that's probably part of it. Morning Glory is also much more vigorous than Sweet Pea, so it's probably doing a really good job of competing. Now, both of these plants can hold their own for the most part, but Morning Glory is probably a bit more of a thug than Sweet Pea is.
The Morning Glory is just overpowering the Sweet Pea?
Some of that, and I think also really the weather has favored Morning Glory more. They tolerate and thrive better in warmer temperatures than Sweet Pea does.
Sure. Well, I guess, like, I've literally gone out there with a tape measure to measure the growth, and it has been stationary. It is growing, but it's been at the same height for about a month now.
And what you may see is that later in the season, as it cools down, it'll pick up again. When it gets into a temperature range that it's a little more happy in.
And keep your tape measure handy.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, I can take some pictures for you if you want. But, yeah.
And while you're collecting data, also record the daily high and low temperature for us, because we may need to make a correlation here.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, Joe, thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, and email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's an email question from Bonnie. This summer, we have found lots of insects, which I believe are strawberry root weevils, in all areas of our home. What's the deal? We haven't noticed them in such numbers in the past, if at all.
Well, what's the deal is you're lucky this year. You get extra strawberry root weevils. They're little tiny black weevils. They have that long snout that we think of as weevils. They are shiny black. They're only about less than a quarter of an inch long, more like 3/16 of an inch long. And they have a peculiar light bulb shape. That is, the head and the thorax are narrow, and then the abdomen is quite round. So if you held them up, they would kind of have the shape of a light bulb. They are accidental invaders that come from the lawn. They live underground 11 months out of the year, where they feed on the roots of plants and not just the roots of strawberries, as their name would imply. And in that 12th month of the year, when they're in the adult stage, they take off and they wander. They have no wings. They can't fly, so they crawl. And as they're crawling across the top of the ground, they bump into your foundation. They climb up the foundation. They come in under the sills or through cracks in the foundation, between the foundation and the siding. And they wander in by mistake. They're just lost. They're off the beaten track. All you need to do is vacuum or sweep them up and throw them back outside.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me today, Donald Lewis, Iowa State University professor of entomology, and Aaron Stile, assistant director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. You're welcome to join us with questions about the plants and insects you encounter. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Aaron Stile is here today, assistant director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University professor of entomology. And here's a question from Tim. My fern leaf peony has powdery mildew on it. It gets this way every year about this time. I know peonies should not be cut until around frost time, but is it okay to cut it back? I find it hard to believe the plant is still receiving nutrients given the way it looks.
Well, if the foliage is really bad, you could cut it off and discard that foliage. I think if you're getting it every year, I would take a real serious look at the location of this plant. Is it in too much shade? Peonies tend to have more powdery mildew when they're not getting enough light. Peony should really have at least 6 hours of direct sunlight. So sunlight hitting the leaves for at least 6 hours. Is it in a spot that's getting good circulation so that that can all help? Are you overhead watering a lot in this area? So if those things are happening and this is something that happens every year, I would also take a step back and see what cultural changes or location changes can be made to help this. Mild powdery mildew, you know, that plant is still being supported by those leaves, and you would want to try to keep those leaves on. If it's really serious, you know, like looking like it's covered in like a flocking that you would put on a Christmas tree or something like that, you could probably remove it regardless whenever you remove it, whether it's now or later in the season when the season's ending. You want to make sure you do good cleanup and get rid of that, get it out of the garden so there's less sticking around to reinfect the following year.
All right, let's go to the phones. Roger's on the line in Eldon. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
What's your question?
Yes, I planted some chestnut trees last fall, 8 of them, and they all wintered very well. They come out and they all leafed out. But all of a sudden, something started eating all the leaves off. And I called the extension office, and all they want is pictures of whatever's happening, and I couldn't find nothing to show them. Couldn't see no webs or anything, and then after about a month or two, the leaves started coming out, and it seems like they were left alone. What can I do next year to prevent this?
Well, maybe not much other than start earlier in looking for either a caterpillar pest. You know, we don't have a lot of experience with chestnut trees because most of them were gone from Iowa before I got here. So I don't have a good mental list of what are the common pests of chestnut. But there probably are some caterpillars. The ones that feed on walnut would also feed. There might be some overlap there with some of our other pests. But I don't have a good name to give you other than start earlier looking for something. And on those small trees, I'm guessing either hand picking would be a good option for control, that you might be able to get ahead of whatever's happening just by picking them off by hand. If necessary, and if you think it's a caterpillar, you could spray them with Bacillus thuringiensis spray or some of the other garden insecticides. But I'm guessing this is a fluke, and if they have re-leafed, you've got good healthy trees, just enjoy them and keep them growing.
Okay. So there's nothing, the local gardens was hesitant about recommending anything that they weren't familiar with. Is a regular insecticide bad for like a nut tree?
No, it's not bad for it, but it may be worthless. And in this kind of an ecosystem, something that is worthless is probably actually worse than worthless, because you would be killing beneficial insects that you may need later on. So what we like to have is a target. Before we use an insecticide, we have to have a target that we're sure will be killed by that insecticide, and that it will achieve what we want it to do at the time we want it to do it. So just a broad-spectrum insecticide would not be recommended. I'm glad the Garden Center gave you that advice, because that's what we've been teaching for the last 60 years. And so until you find a pest and until we identify it, I would hold off on spraying and just keep looking.
All right, Roger. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Bonnie in North Liberty. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question today?
Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear us, Bonnie?
Yes, now I can.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. What's your question?
So my question, I think, is very basic, but I've taken over gardening. My husband passed away, and so I'm trying to manage a pretty large town yard and garden. And I have a lot of forsythia, lilac, honeysuckle, kind of your basic yard bushes, and they just look like they're going crazy. Can I still prune those this summer, or do I need to wait till next spring? What's the best time to do that?
Oh, Bonnie, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Yeah, some pruning advice?
Yeah. So, they probably have gone crazy this summer. Ideally, we would wait until spring to do this pruning. Now, for things like forsythia and lilac, often we recommend pruning happen right after flowering, because if you do it before the flowering, you might lose some of that floral display. If they're really out of control, you can still do it before they flower. And ideally, for most woody plants, we recommend pruning in late winter, early spring, the month of March, basically. And you could do it then, or you could do it right after they're done flowering. Probably the most challenging time for the plant to prune would be in the fall. Because when you prune, you're encouraging new growth. And this time of year, that new growth comes out, and it is not well suited to overwinter. So you cause a lot of stress on the plant that way. So if it can wait, if it's not a branch that's smacking you in the head every time you walk into your door or something like that, if it can wait, late winter, early spring would be good, or immediately after they're finished flowering for that early blooming stuff.
And what I feel are basic questions, I often spend some time looking through Iowa State University Extension pamphlets. Mm-hmm. This sounds like maybe something Bonnie could benefit from,
taking a
look at some of the pruning pamphlets, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and there's some really great resources on Iowa State Extension page for this, and just a really great search function, too.
Bonnie, thank you so much for your call, and best of luck to you. Let's go now to Karen in Des Moines. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Yes, what's your question?
I live on the east side of Des Moines, and my folks had this land for lots of years, and so I know the soil is usually pretty rich, but since I've been working with it, it hasn't been. So I've been putting manure on it and different kinds of things to try to get it. It's really sandy. It just gets really, really sandy, unusually sandy, with a lot of ants and a lot of squinnies. So I'm wondering if this is kind of one of the climate deals, or Any thoughts on that?
I think what you're doing is good. When you have kind of loose soil like that, adding compost is a really great way to improve that soil structure. There are conifer growers everywhere who would love to have this situation. So there are certain plants that prefer this more than others. But I think, you know, there's a whole host of and probably more than one things that have come together to kind of create whatever situation that you have there. And so for us to speculate on it would be probably a little difficult. But what you're doing to address it is really good.
And the ants are helping you. Ants are beneficial because they help aerate the soil. They stir the soil. They put organic matter into the soil. Occasionally, they're in the wrong spot, and we do treat the mounds as they appear. But the ants are good for you. Squinties come and go. What can we say? They're going to be there, whether it's ground squirrels or chipmunks. They're going to come and go, and you got two choices. One is to hate them, or one is to admire how cute they are. And you get to take your pick.
And sometimes different days.
You can have two opinions in the same day.
That's right. That's right. Karen, thanks a lot for your call. Tom is up next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Tom. All right. I'm not hearing Tom, so let's go to Marge in Corydon. Hi, Marge.
Hello.
What's your question?
I have a question about a bug I saw in my house last night and this morning. Last night I saw two of them. And I caught them and got rid of them. They were black and about almost maybe an inch long. And I didn't see them fly. And they were easy to capture.
Okay.
And this morning I saw these were in the living room. I had the lamp on and I don't have the air going on right now. So I have screens and things like that, so they could maybe get in.
Mm-hmm.
And this morning I found one in the bathroom, so I just wondered, what are they? And I have a man who comes twice a year and sprays for me, and I'm going to tell him about them.
Sure.
But I don't know if he'll know what they were, what they are.
Well, the next one you get, you could save in a Ziploc bag and put it in your freezer and then show it to your pest control specialist when they come, and that kind of helps with the identification. Black and one inch long is kind of vague to work with, but this is the time of the year when ground beetles are quite active, and your description fits them. They are attracted to lights. They are outdoor insects that feed on other insects, so outdoors they are beneficial. They live on the ground, as their name implies, but ground beetles are active, and they get up at night, and they fly around, and they fly to the lights, and they're around your porch lights, and maybe they crawled in around the door. So if they're a hard-shelled beetle type of a thing in that black one-inch long, I would consider them an accidental invader, and you've done already what I would suggest, and that is pick them up and discard them.
All right, Marge, thank you so much for your call. Mary is up next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Thank you for, I listen to your show all as often as I can. And
oh, thanks,
I know
Mary.
You are not supposed to cut oak trees at this time of the year. You have to
You're
wait till winter
listener.
Time.
Yep.
Yes. But I had a guy coming to cut down some trees that was shading my solar panels. And he trimmed my mulberry and basswood to get his truck down. But in the meantime, he cut off maybe a 1.5-inch branch of my oak tree. What should I do about that wound?
Oh, you know, our plant pathologist friends say you can paint it with a heavy coat of latex paint.
Latex paint?
Yep.
Okay.
Something like house paint that will seal it shut. The pruning paints... don't seal well enough. So we don't need a tar. We don't need an asphalt product. Just a latex paint that will not be toxic to the wood would seal that over in case any random sap beetle
yes,
is going.
Yes, because they are about 10 years old and they are doing very well. And he just cut off the branch, but he left like, oh, I bet 4 inches. From the tree.
Oh, he left a stub. That's not good.
So, yes.
So you've got a chance to cut it again, and then when it's a fresh cut, you can put the paint on that.
Paint on?
Yep, paint the latex paint.
Cut it up to the trunk.
Not flush with the trunk. When you look at where that branch connects to the tree, There'll be a kind of a collar around it.
Oh, yeah,
kind
great. Of like I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you'll want to keep that on the tree and remove everything beyond it.
Mm-hmm. I will do that, but just simple latex paint.
Yes, and pick a brown or a green. It'll blend in.
Yeah, because I know that he did not do it with my permission because he would never got it.
Oh, Mary, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well.
Best of luck. Yeah.
My solar panels get all the sun, but he caused a problem with the oak tree. But,
yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Mary. And let's get through some email questions here. This is a question from Jeff. What's the best treatment for getting rid of bagworms, and when is the best time of year for using the treatment?
One of the best treatments is Bacillus thuringiensis spray applied in June when the bagworms are small. Aaron and I were talking before the show that we have had more bagworm calls this year than the last few years combined. Yeah. So bagworms have done very well with the winter weather that we have had the last few years. Bagworms are small caterpillars that carry a little bag around with them. They don't make a web over the end of the branch. Each caterpillar carries its own little bag. They are nearly at the end of their feeding cycle for this summer. So spraying now with a synthetic insecticide like 7 or 8 or any of the other commercial products might get you a little control, but you're behind the curve. You should have done it back in the third week of June.
All right. Unfortunately, that's not when people necessarily see them, is it?
Oh, and in fact, it's very hard to see them when they're small because that bag camouflages them very well.
So put a note on your calendar for next year because they'll probably be back.
Assuming we get another mild winter, they will be back.
All right. Here's a question from Lauren. I have lots of varieties of viburnums. All are looking good, except this year the double file viburnums have leafed out, and then the leaves die back, and the branches are empty. It seems like it's continuing from early spring, and I've just lost my place in that email, but my computer's not cooperating with me, but what do you think?
Well, there are a few vascular diseases that can impact viburnum. And so one of the things you can do is collect a sample. Hopefully it's still alive. A dead sample won't be beneficial, but if it's something that you're really concerned about, you can collect a sample and submit it to see if that is indeed what's going on. Sometimes you can see the damage. There'll be a dark ring or discoloration on the cut end when you remove the branch. These are fairly common for viburnum. On some of them, you just you trim them back and they'll come back from the base and it won't be a big issue. Double file is a little different style viburnum in that it doesn't sucker as much. So this one might hit this plant a little harder because of that. Make sure that you are cleaning your tools well, disinfecting pruners and loppers and saws that you might have used, using a 10% bleach solution. So just 1 part bleach to 9 part water. Let it sit in there for a minute or two to get it nice and clean. That way you will not accidentally spread this to some of the other viburnums in your
yard. He says it's been affecting young and older plants. So
yeah.
All right. Yeah. Here's a question from Barbara. I live in North Ames, and after I mowed this week, my shoes, mower, and collection bag on the mower were all covered with fine orangish red dust.
Yes.
Yes.
We've had this question several times, even this week.
So what is it?
It's rust. It's a fungal disease on the blades of the turf grass. The weather conditions have been perfect for its development in big parts of the state this year. There's nothing that we recommend spraying on it to get rid of it. Usually just maintaining a nice, healthy lawn is all that needs to be done. You might, if you're not cutting the lawn at least 2.5 inches or taller, you probably should be, especially this time of year. That would help. But apart from that, there's nothing that you need to spray or do. Just do what you can to promote a healthy lawn, and it'll grow out of it.
All right. Aaron Style, thank you.
You're welcome.
Aaron Style, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Donald Lewis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Professor of Entomology. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.